This is Rabbi Shai Held, Parashat Mishpatim 5775. Hearing the cries of the defenseless, or we are all responsible. Biblical laws make specific, concrete demands upon us. But discerning the meaning of those laws for our own time can sometimes be extremely difficult. How does a law rooted in the ancient world continue to speak, inspire, challenge, and provoke even in our own radically different one? Parashat Mishpatim offers a fascinating case study. The Torah teaches, "You shall not oppress any widow, almana, or orphan." According to some scholars, an almana in the Torah is not equivalent to a widow in our modern context. By widow, we mean a woman whose husband has died. But in the ancient world, the primary issue is not whether a woman's husband has died, but whether there are any male relatives to be responsible for her after his passing. Ordinarily, Bible scholar Paula Hebert notes, the widow's maintenance would have been the responsibility of either her sons or her father-in-law. When these male persons were non-existent, then the widow became an almana. The Torah worries that the almana has no one to provide for her, and, worse, that she has no one to protect her from those who would prey on the defenseless, especially since they fear no reprisals from outraged family members. Both the almana and the orphan have lost their male advocate and protector, and so are exposed to endless social threat. The Torah's primary concern seems to be with the socioeconomic vulnerability of the widow and the orphan, but, subtly picking up on the Torah's phrasing, "You shall not oppress any widow or orphan," Maimonides focuses our attention on their psychological vulnerability as well. Quote, "A person must be extremely careful in interacting with orphans and widows, because their spirits are very low and their feelings are depressed. This applies even if they are wealthy, even if they are the widow and the orphan of a king." Maimonides weaves together the Torah's demand for probity in the economic sphere and its concern with emotional sensitivity in the relational one. Quote, "How should one interact with them? One should speak to them only gently and treat them only with respect. One should cause pain neither to their body with overwork nor to their heart with words, and one should show more consideration for their financial interests than for one's own. One who oppresses a widow or an orphan or causes them financial loss, let alone one who beats or curses them, violates the Torah's prohibition," Maimonides emphasizes, "but so also does one who vexes or angers them or hurts their feelings." God warns of dire consequences if people mistreat the widow and the orphan. Quote, "If you do oppress them, I will hear their outcry as soon as they cry out to me, and my anger shall blaze forth, and I will put you to the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children orphans." Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra notes that the text shifts between speaking to the Israelites in the singular and addressing them in the plural. "Do not oppress" is in the plural. "If you do oppress" is in the singular. "And I will put you to the sword" is again in the plural. And explains that the Torah expands the circle of responsibility to include not only those who oppress the widows and the orphans, but also, quote, "those who see the oppression and remain silent. Therefore it is written, if you, singular, do oppress them, I will kill you," plural. In a society where some are oppressed, all are implicated. There are no innocent bystanders. In the ancient Near East, and indeed in much of Tanakh, it is the duty of the king to protect those who are vulnerable and exposed. In a variety of contexts, the protection of the weak was seen as the will of the god, and in Israel, of God. And since the king represented the god's rule on earth, it was he who was tasked with being their earthly protector. Ibn Ezra's insight thus points to a crucial but easy-to-miss dimension of the text. The law of the widow and orphan in Parashat Mishpatim represents a radical democratization of moral responsibility. The whole society, and not just the king, is responsible to ensure that the widow and the orphan are not abused. For the Torah, God is the ultimate protector of the powerless, but all Israel must be their proximate protector. Momentously, God declares of the widows and the orphans that God will hear Shamoa Eshma, their outcry, as soon as they cry out to me. That language is reminiscent of God's having heard, Vayishma, the cries of the Israelites as they moaned under Egyptian bondage. The same fate awaits these oppressors as that which fell on the Egyptians. The point is profound and powerful. Just as God is moved to respond by the suffering inflicted upon Israel, so also is God moved to respond by the suffering inflicted by Israel. Quote, as the cry of Israel against Egypt mobilized God, so now the cry of widows and orphans will mobilize God against oppressive Israel. The prohibition on oppressing widows and orphans is presented in tandem with a similar prohibition on mistreating the stranger. Quote, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Taken together, these laws point to the heart of the Torah's vision. God wants Israel to create an anti-Egypt, a society in which the weak and defenseless are protected rather than exploited, loved rather than degraded. Accordingly, God's people must not show any sign that they are becoming like the Egyptians in how they treat others, whether fellow Israelites or aliens living among them. God's self-identification as the patron of the powerless is central to the goals of the text. The dramatic, and for a legal code uncharacteristic, shift from a second-person prohibition, you shall not, to an impassioned first-person declaration, I will hear and my anger shall blaze forth, is highly suggestive. First, it points to just how central compassionate treatment of the vulnerable is to God's hopes for how Israel is to live. Indeed, just a few verses later, God says that when someone behaves mercilessly towards the poor, God will respond, for I am compassionate, Chanun. To behave compassionately is thus to walk in God's ways, to partake in some small way in God's own compassion. Second, and more concretely, the warning may imply that human government was not well equipped to protect the rights of widows and orphans, and that God was thus their only recourse. This may also explain the ferocity of the threat. Your own wives shall become widows and your children orphans. While God would obviously prefer that the widow and the orphan escape abuse because the powerful are kind and compassionate, God's first concern is to ensure that mistreatment does not take place. So threats, even dire ones, also have their place. What are we to make of these verses today, when, in some parts of the world at least, women are, blessedly, no longer as vulnerable and defenseless when their spouses die? Sometimes biblical laws are meant to be illustrative rather than exhaustive. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel writes that the prophets tried to teach how to think in the categories of God, God's holiness, justice, and compassion. The appropriation of these categories, far from exempting us from the obligation to gain new insights in our own time, is a challenge to look for ways of translating biblical commandments into programs required by our own conditions. As I have explained elsewhere, Heschel does not spell out or offer examples of what he has in mind here, but I think he intends something like this. Biblical laws are to be understood not merely as concrete norms, but also as paradigms. In other words, they invite each generation to develop contemporary commitments that apply the eternal essence of the laws to particular times. Thus, for example, a modern reader who learns of the biblical requirement to build a parapet around one's roof will discern from the concrete norm that the Torah is concerned with a broader commitment to public safety. Similarly, one who reads of God's compassionate concern for the plight of widows and orphans should perceive in the Torah's words a broader mandate to champion the cause of the vulnerable and powerless, whoever they may be in a particular society. To refuse to read biblical norms as paradigms is, willy-nilly, to destine significant swaths of the Torah to irrelevance. If there are no longer almanot in the biblical sense, after all, then the Torah's words may be beautiful, but they are also inconsequential. If we do not read such norms as paradigms, in other words, we run the very real risk of domesticating the Torah by admiring it, even as we rob it of its normative force. Bible scholar Terence Fredheim suggests that readers of the Torah are invited to extrapolate from the specifics of biblical law along the grain of the original formulations. Reading our verses, he insists, we are invited to extend our concern to include any injustice that might occasion the cries of the disadvantaged. When the Israelites can no longer bear their oppression in Egypt, we learn, God both hears their moaning and sees them. To be a religious person is, in part, to follow God's examples, to listen even when others will not, and to see even when others look away. Shabbat Shalom.